a week and a half after the Altair 8800, which was really, really early. Open source was a thing. It was an amorphous thing because there was no real money involved in it, I think, originally. As soon as anyone actually built something that wasn't university-based, everything got locked down, and especially the fact that almost one stole Bill Gates' basic interpreter had a little bit of a reason for that happening. But, I mean, pretty much all the software from the Altair 8800 on was commercial and was somewhat locked down. It was only in the 80s and the 90s that open source really had a renewed existence, in my experience at least.
Mitch Kapoor, he wrote the first viable software program for business called Lotus 123. And when he was developing that, we all had a copy of it, a free copy of it. And open source started because, software is built on modules. So people didn't want to have to rewrite what somebody already wrote. And decades later, you have something called GitHub now, where everybody shares all bits of their little programs. And that's the thing that Microsoft realized, that they can't control GitHub. You know, they can't corner the market. And there's also the tech support that they want to get away from. Go ahead, Roy.
Rich, do you happen to know who owns GitHub?
Yeah, doesn't Google?
Oh, Microsoft owns GitHub.
Microsoft, well, again, what's becoming more and more evident because of, they're not making any money off of GitHub. Do you think they're making money off of GitHub, or are they? Maybe there's something, I don't know.
I would doubt that they do. They do it for the public relations, and so when people complain that they're trying to lock people out of open source and such, they could say, no, we actually own and maintain one of the largest open source facilities in the world. So that's their get-out-of-jail card, as far as I could see. The economic models for software development shift every couple of microseconds. This week, it's all about being in the cloud. If all these companies could spend all their resources into building cloud-based servers and storage devices, they would be happy campers in their minds. So that's where the business is going this week. Where it'll go next week, who knows? If you know, then you probably should invest in some stock.
They're really two separate issues. The distribution of software, that's like the distribution of movies. You know, eventually it'll all be satellite to the different movie theaters instead of bicycling, what they call bicycling prints of a movie. I don't know what percentage of movie houses are already doing it like that, but, you know, so that's the distribution end of it. But Microsoft gobbled up GitHub, not as a profit center, because it's just an exchange of the coders. It's just an exchange, and then to show off their work and to have other people fork it. The term is to fork it. Anybody can add to anybody's software. So when Microsoft saw this, they said, we better own something like that. You're right, for public relations reasons, but also we can't develop software anymore. It's too interchangeable, the modules that make it up on GitHub.
Yet Windows OS is ubiquitous for all the people who love Apple, iOS and OS X and Linux. Microsoft itself is going to include a Linux kernel in future versions of Windows 10. It's going to do it in a virtual machine, so it's kind of shelved off. But they'll have that access too. I don't know what the future of computing ultimately is. I'm kind of pleased that Gates himself got it completely wrong. He discounted the entire internet when it exploded around him. So it only goes to show you can have an incredibly great business sense and be a very poor prognosticator. I'm looking forward to new things. I don't think everything's going to go open source because life isn't that simple. They'll be open source. There'll also be, unfortunately, subscription services, which kind of you have to pay for every day of your life, and they'll be pay and play as well. It'll be a fascinating thing to watch.
Issue with a comment.
Feel free to comment.
One of the things, even with open source, you're going to have regulatory compliance issues where somebody has to be liable for the software that they're writing. Companies such as banks and industries like that are going to need to have some proof that documents are secure and things won't get broken into or hacked or leakage. So there's definitely that interesting piece to it.
There's money to be made. I would assume that that is partially the business model of places like Red Hat Linux, which kind of aimed themselves towards the business community and kind of gave them a degree of assurance that they weren't going to kind of fall into a pit with open source software. Questions or comments before I move on to yet the next story?
Law firms are built on, you know, that comes with each piece of software, but I think the lawyers will cover everybody for, you know, I mean, if you can answer the phone while you're using the software, they're not liable, or, you know, whatever ridiculous stuff lawyers come up with. Anyway, so open source it is, and there was a book originally written by Ted Nelson called Computer Lib, you know, a hippie book, Power to the People, and it's come full circle, almost. W2BZ.
EULA agreements, those little I agree that scroll for 15 minutes and then you don't read any of it and you click I agree and you're never quite sure what you agree to. EULA agreements are not money they're not printed on, so and he was prescient. I read his book. He was a big proponent of what he was calling hypertext. He didn't really think of it in terms of a worldwide network of links. He thought of it as more of a self-contained series of links, but hypertext has sort of morphed into the internet, and it's changed everyone's life.
Impressive, Roy. Not many people, one in a million, not only know about Ted Nelson's book, but know about hypertext and know about what he intended and what he didn't intend. Kudos to you, Doctor.
Thank you, Rich. I mean, ultimately, it was just that I was there at the time, so I was a witness. Fascinating. I wish I would have kept my issues of Popular Electronics from those days, where they actually gave instructions on the assembly of the first home PC bit in a chipset and such. I would have given anything at that young age to have one, even though it didn't really do much of anything. So I've been following this particular story pretty much from its beginning.
Queens boy is amongst people who started the home computer business or microcomputer business. A computer boy who is the from Queens is the one who is termed the grandfather or the godfather of the computer business. And I'll be damned if his name didn't go. He was the editor of Popular Electronics. And he put his career on the line to put a little thing called an elf on the cover. His publisher didn't want him to do it. And, Les Solomon is his name. And the Sol computer was named after him. And his daughter named the Altair the Altair. Anyway, enough of computer memory lane.
Very good, Rich. And the Altair, the first computer, microcomputer, sold for hobbyists, the revolutionized and started the whole thing rolling, and the poor guy who manufactured those parts got so disenchanted by the industry that he decided to quit manufacturing, to medical school, and he's practicing medicine to this day.
Derek Roberts?
I believe that's was his name. Is his name. Any other questions or comments, or I'll move on to the next story. Well, physicists have confirmed yet another prediction. Stephen Hawking's namesake of black holes using a black hole they constructed in their lab, according to a new paper. This black hole isn't like the usual black holes in space, though, where gravity creates regions of space-time so warped that light can't escape. Instead, the researchers built a black hole analog using a strange quantum material called a Bose-Einstein condensate, in which the point of no return is for sound waves rather than light. Still, it's an important verification of Hawking's work. Stephen Hawking's landmark theory is called Hawking radiation. When trying to apply the physical laws governing heat to black holes, he realized that black holes must emit radiation from their surfaces. The mechanism marks a combination of quantum mechanics, the source, the science of the smallest, with gravity, the science of interactions between the most massive things. But as astronomers have been able to peer close enough to a black hole, haven't been able to peer close enough to a black hole to prove or disprove the theory. Some scientists have instead turned to analogs in the lab. Let me drop for a sec. The scientists created an elongated Bose-Einstein condensate by trapping 8,000 rubidium atoms in a focused laser beam. Bose-Einstein condensates are systems of ultra-cold atoms where strange quantum physical phenomena become more visible on a larger scale. They are often used for analog-type experiments just like these. A second laser increases the potential energy on one side of the Bose-Einstein condensate, making it denser on that side. A sharp transition separates the denser area, considered to be outside the black hole, and the less dense area, considered to be inside the black hole. This transition moves at a constant speed through the condensate, but from the point of view of the experimenters, it appears to be stationary. Instead, it looks as if all of the rubidium atoms are moving. Outside the black hole in the denser region, the speed of sound is faster than the speed of this flow, so that sound wave can move in either direction. But in the less dense region, inside the black hole, the speed of sound is slower. So sound waves only travel away from the sharp transition and further into the black hole, as described in the paper published in Nature. This experiment mimics one of the most important features of the black hole. Outside the black hole, light can either move away from or into the black hole. But once inside the black hole, it cannot escape. The laboratory analog replaces light with sound, and the researchers can measure sound waves both outside and inside their black hole's event horizon. The signal of the Hawking radiation is a correlation between these two types of waves. Drop for a second. Steinhauer's team previously observed Hawking radiation in this system back in 2016, but this time around they made at least 21 improvements to the system in order to get a better signal. This was enough to pull out important information about the system's radiation, namely that it has a thermal spectrum with a signature with a temperature determined only by the system's analogous equivalent to gravity, a relationship between the speed of sound and its flow. This means that it emitted a continuous spectrum of wavelengths rather than a preferred wavelength. These observations and temperatures were exactly as predicted in Hawking. Mathematicians like Sylph White Weinfurter at the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom wrote in a Nature commentary that the research was promising and that the scheme the researchers used to extract the temperature of the radiation was clever. Perhaps, she wrote, the setup will be useful in measuring other interesting quantum phenomena expected to occur near a black hole's event horizon. This research is yet another example of scientists using analogs to access physical phenomena that might otherwise be impossible to observe. It can serve as an important verification of the theories that drive our understanding of inaccessible things. Next up, the researchers hope to repeatedly redo the experiment in order to determine how this Hawking radiation changes over time. And who knows, maybe one day we will really be able to measure these properties in an actual black hole. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is KC2GS. Okay, on to the story then. There's been a bit more news on that Chinese geneticist we talked about before, the one still under house arrest for toying with those infants' genes. The world's first genetically edited babies could have a shortened life expectancy, apparently. In 2018, Chinese scientist Yi Zhongku claimed he used the CRISPR tool to disable the CCR5 gene in the embryos of twin girls, Lulu and Nana. The twins, he theorized, would be protected from HIV. Now research published in the journal Nature Medicine suggests he might have shortened the girls' actual life expectancies. As MIT Technology Review reports, researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, analyzed the DNA and death records of more than 400,000 volunteers in the United Kingdom's Biobank, a large British gene bank. When they matched the DNA with death records, discovered that people with two non-working CCR5 genes passed away 20% faster than the rest of the sample population. Now, that might be because people with CCR5 mutations appear to be more susceptible to illnesses like West Nile virus or influenza. According to the report, mutations similar to those Hay created shortened people's lives by an average of 1.9 years. Researchers hope this will serve as a cautionary tale. Like many genes, CCR5 serves multiple purposes, at least some of which we don't fully understand. Earlier this year, researchers published in the journal Cell that people who lack CCR5 genes may recover faster after a stroke or traumatic brain injury. That suggests it could play a role in brain function as well as immunity. It also suggests that editing the gene could have an unintended consequence, and those opposed say it's one more reason we shouldn't be gene editing people, at least not quite yet. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WB2GX,
yes, Rich.
The CRISPR, whatever it is, was the subject of lengthy discussion on NPR radio this afternoon, which I listened to with great interest while I was in the car. What exactly is CRISPR?
Rich, you're the second guy who asked me, and one of these days I'm actually going to look it all up. My guess is it's somewhat complicated and difficult to kind of address completely on the radio. It's using enzymes preferentially to find areas in gene patterns that then get broken apart, and then other enzymes that rebuild the fragments. But it's probably a lot more involved, and one of these days, I guess, I will really have to read up a lot on it and do a little story purely on CRISPR.
Okay, so you wouldn't know if it was just one machine or a system of chemicals all bound together by one standard, etc.
The system, it's not simply a machine that you push a button and it does that. There are multiple steps involved. They haven't gotten to the point where they're automating these things. These things are labor intensive and require a series of stages.
Radio program seems to concur with your conclusions. We shouldn't be messing around with stuff because every change has unintended side effects and consequences. WB2GXM.
The nature of humanity, be it good or bad, is that if a thing can be done, we tend to ultimately do it. We should do it with more knowledge than we're doing it right now. We should do it with a lot more forethought than we do now. But I think there is ultimately no way to stop mankind from twiddling with the genes of the future. Assuming that civilization continues and grows and doesn't even accelerate, but just stays at this incredible rate that it is now, it will probably be unimaginable what human beings will look and sound and be able to do 1,000 years from now. Because you know people are going to design better human beings. It's our nature. It's our plus and our minus. We do it for good, we do it for not quite good. So in the short haul, yes, I agree with you, absolutely, but ultimately, I think it's a losing battle. I think if you give enough people a hammer, they're going to use hammers. Even if you put it in a box with a big sign that says, caution, the government will not allow you to use this, they will find a way to use it. Okay, on to the next, and I'm sure you're looking forward to another story of measles. The Center for Disease and Prevention, Disease Control and Prevention, said a few weeks ago that 1,001 cases of measles have been reported so far in the U.S. throughout 2019. That number is all but certain to continue climbing in the second half of this year. A couple weeks ago, the CDC warned that the U.S. measles cases had reached a 25-year high, with more measles infection reported than any year since 1994, when 958 cases occurred. The CDC said at the time that if the outbreaks continue to spread, the U.S. risks losing the elimination status it has held since 2000. When the agency declared that measles was effectively eradicated in the country due to the absence of continuous disease transmission for greater than 12 months. Per CNN, more than half of all states have reported cases so far in 2019, but most of them have been in New York State, with the major outbreaks centered around Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods in New York City's borough of Brooklyn and Queens. Congratulations, everyone. As well as Rockland County, further upstate, nearly 700 of the cases reported this year are located in New York. Washington State's Clark County had the second largest outbreak at more than 70 cases, CNN added, while another outbreak of 44 cases in Michigan was recently declared over by health officials. Measles was once a terror, with the CDC estimating that 3 to 4 million individuals in the U.S. came down with the virus annually before a vaccine was released in 1963, resulting in 48,000 hospitalizations and 400 to 500 deaths a year. Close to all the children had measles infections by the age of 15. Let me drop for a sec. In 2014, the CDC estimated that vaccinations administered to children born during the 20-year era since the beginning of the Vaccines for Children program in 1994 had stopped 21 million hospitalizations and 732,000 deaths in their lifetimes. That program was partially launched in response to hundreds of deaths from the measles virus over the years 1989 to 1991. The well-established opinion of the medical and scientific community, reiterated over the course of countless studies, is that vaccines are safe and effective. One major factor in the measles resurgence has been a decline in vaccination rates, with factors including families missing doctor's visits and a troubling growth in those who ask for non-medical exemption. The non-medical exemption rate appears to be tied to anti-vaxxers, a movement of conspiracy theorists with an anti-government tinge who parrot any number of false claims about vaccines, most notably that they cause a range of ailments from autism to non-existent conditions like vaccine overload. Reports have indicated that anti-vaxxers have become alarmingly organized in recent years, driven in part by the spreading misinformation on social media. Members of the movement staged a rally in Washington State to oppose legislation that restricted non-medical vaccine exemptions earlier this year. Other reports indicate that a small but dedicated anti-vax group with ties to a national anti-vax organization had blanketed some of the impacted neighborhoods in New York City with propaganda flyers. Let me drop for a sec. In the CDC's news release, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said that the U.S. health authorities have the ultimate goal of stopping the outbreak and the spread of misinformation about vaccines. Quote, We cannot say this enough. Vaccines are safe and highly effective public health tools that can prevent this disease and end the current outbreak, Acer said. The measles vaccine is among the most studied medical products we have and is given safely to millions of children and adults each year. Measles is an incredibly contagious and dangerous disease. I encourage all Americans to talk to their doctor about vaccines are recommended to protect them, your family, and your community from measles and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Just this past week, New York legislature voted to repeal the vaccine exemption for religious reasons in school-aged children in their ongoing battle against the growing measles outbreak in this state. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next then. New results from the world's largest particle accelerator illuminate the structure of something called a pentaquark, an exotic particle consisting of five quarks bound together. Quarks, the subatomic particles that make up protons and neutrons, usually bind together in pairs or triplets to form classes of particles called mesons and baryons, respectively. But recent analysis of data taken at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, have revealed the existence of larger aggregations, like the five-quark pentaquark. Now, scientists have been able to crunch even more data to understand how the quarks are arranged in these odd pentaquark particles. It appears, in fact, that researchers observed the baryon bound to a meson, forming a weird new kind of unearthly molecule. The LHC machinery accelerates packets of protons to nearly the speed of light, then injects them into a pair of magnetic circles that intercept all four points. The high-energy particles collide, releasing energy and mass in the form of other particles that are inaccessible here on Earth. Detectors like the Large Hadron Collider B detector sit at these collision points and record the resulting spray of particles. Scientists compare the data to the laws of physics as they understand them, hoping to find unobserved but predictable particles, unexpected deviations from those laws. Back in 2015, and confirmed in 2016, our scientists first observed a pair of peaks in their data analysis, a literal peak on a graph, where they saw more hits in the detector than otherwise expected. The peaks indicated the presence of assemblages of five quarks, known as a pentaquark, approximately 4.5 times the mass of a proton. But questions remain unanswered as to the nature of these particles, such as their internal configuration. Let me drop for a sec. Taking a whole lot more data, Large Hadron Collider B researchers detected yet another pentaquark and determined that one of the pentaquarks discovered in 2015 was actually two pentaquarks close in mass. This time around, the researchers realized that the peaks were very skinny, meaning that they were able to get the high-resolution measurements of the pentaquark's mass. The high-resolution piece is important by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. There is a relationship between how well you can measure the energy of a particle and how you can measure the amount of time it takes for the particle to decay. If the particle were to decay quickly, the researchers wouldn't be able to get the skinny peaks that they observed. The theory that pentaquarks is actually a three-quark particle and a two-quark particle bound together would explain these long lifetimes. Under this theory, it's almost like a pair of exotic particles are bound together in some sort of strange molecule that could only exist at energies created at the Large Hadron Collider. This molecule would be held together by strong nuclear force rather than electromagnetism, the force that binds most molecules. Now, don't expect pentaquarks to find any practical use here on Earth. They tend to decay very quickly. But maybe they exist at the center of strange objects in space, like neutron stars. The two-quark, three-quark molecule theory isn't the only way to explain the observation, though, according to a paper published in Physical Review Letters. As usual, more experimental and theoretical scrutiny will be required to completely nail down the internal structure of these odd little pentaquarks. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, Doc, I guess we'll go on to the next one. Any optical clock that is small enough to fit onto three computer chips has been created by physicists at the National Institute of Standards Technology in Boulder, Colorado. The next generation device is 100 times more stable than current chip-based atomic clocks of similar size. With further improvements, the tiny timekeeper could have a diverse range of both scientific and commercial applications. For over six decades, the most accurate timekeeping device has been atomic clocks, the best of which could run for more than 1 billion years before being off by just 1 second. Most commercial atomic clocks operate by monitoring the frequency of microwaves emitted by a certain transition in a cesium atom. However, the best atomic clocks use transitions that emit light, which has a much higher frequency than microwaves. As a result, these optical clocks are much more accurate than their microwave counterparts. The downside, however, is that optical clocks are bulky, complex, and expensive, limiting their use to labs such as NIST. NIST researchers are keen to simplify optical clocks and put them on chips so that they can find wider application. Their design is based around a microfabricated glass vapor cell filled with rubidium atoms, which have a transition at 385 terahertz. While this is not quite visible light, it is in the infrared, and it is much higher than the cesium transition at 9 gigahertz. Let me drop for a second. An infrared clock laser is a lock to the rubidium transition. Two interlocking Caro micro resonator frequency comb filters are used to convert the terahertz clock laser time signal into a gigahertz frequency, which is widely used by standard electronics. The simplicity of this design is meant that the clock could be incredibly compact. It fits onto just three chips, and it does not require supporting electronics and optics. Using just 275 milliwatts of power, the device showed an instability of just one part in 10 to the 13th after operating 1,000 seconds. This makes it around 100 times more stable than the current atomic clocks of a similar size. With further improvements, NIST team believes that their optical clock could become small enough to be handheld, making it highly competitive with current atomic clocks. If optical clocks become small, portable, and inexpensive, though, they would be suitable for a range of commercial applications, including timing and navigation when GPS is unavailable. It would also open up new opportunities for scientific experiments, including gravitational and remote sensing, long baseline interferometry, and connection of lab equipment, potentially allowing for new tests of fundamental aspects of physics. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is KC2. Yes. Okay, so much for optical atomic clocks. Let's try something old and new again, cold fusion. Hold on to your hats, guys. The dubious field of cold fusion may be back again thanks to those people at Google. Scientists at Google and several research institutes in North America have reopened what they call the cold case of cold fusion. The researchers argue that those dismissing work on cold fusion, for which there is no reproducible experimental evidence, may have been premature in their assessment of its worth. Team has also carried out experiments of its own, which did not provide any evidence for cold fusion, but despite that, many failures to observe cold fusion, the scientists maintain that the case is not yet closed. They also argue that cold fusion research benefits other areas of science and technology. Cold fusion, for you guys who forget, hit the headlines 30 years ago in 1989 when chemists Martin Fleischmann of the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom and Stanley Pons of the University of Utah in the United States announced at a press conference in Utah that they have observed nuclear fusion in a remarkably simple experiment. When passing electricity through samples of heavy water containing palladium electrodes, they reported the net production of energy as well as the detection of neutrons and tritium. The reaction responsible, they claimed, must have been nuclear rather than chemical. This meant that some unknown mechanism had caused the deuterium nuclei in the electrodes to overcome their mutual electrostatic repulsion and get close enough to fuse. Let me drop for a second. Yes, Paul.
I keyed up too late, but on the last topic with the clocks, I have a topic related to that. So when I bring that up later, it's definitely related to what you were talking about. you know, it has to do with the deep space atomic clock that's going to be launched on next Monday. So that's not a dead topic. I'll be bringing that same subject up later.
Fine. It's a little bit different in that these chips are still experimental. They're incredible high accuracy because they use optical frequencies. In the past, optical frequencies required rather large, heavy comb filters to utilize optical frequencies, but apparently they have designed things that can fit into small chips. And so, as I wrote you, this is a never-ending type of field of endeavor. The atomic clocks, no doubt, will get smaller, lighter, more efficient, less energy, and incredibly more accurate somehow. So this, you know, the one that you talk about is based on mercury vapor ions, and these are rubidium. But the basis is all the same. They use different frequencies. And you'll get into it soon, and I'll be glad to join in.
Okay, copy that. Yeah, the one I'm talking about is UV, so... That's what you told me, it was UV. So it's not optical. It's the same theory. Okay.
Yeah, mercury ion atomic clocks that have been developed by the NIST use the UV frequencies for their accuracy, but the one that you're going to report on is using a hyperfine transition all the way down to 40 gigahertz. So it's microwave at that technology, but it's very accurate microwave. The higher the frequency standard, the better resolution, the better accuracy you can tune these things to. So optical is preferred over microwave. But still, it's small, it's efficient, and it's very accurate. So mercury ion might prove to be just the solution.
Okay, the ones you're talking about sound better, though, because they're getting into three little chips. Well, the one I'm talking about is as big as a toaster. So, okay, I'll let you continue on. I just want to let you know that's not a dead topic.
Atomic clocks will never be a dead topic, and I think the difference, unfortunately, is that these chips are still in their experimental phase. I'm not sure if they've tested them for environmental functions. You want something that's absolutely positively guaranteed to survive strange outer space environments, and I don't think they've had the opportunity to test this design for that basis. So that'll maybe be some future version of this technology.
Okay, very good. So, you know, anybody that's listening will kind of figure out what we're talking about. They do have a launch going up next week. And one of the satellites that are going to be on board is a test satellite using one of these very small atomic clocks. So I'll be reporting on that later. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, very good, Paul. So getting back to the curious case of cold fusion, hailed by some at the time as a virtually inexhaustible source of clean nuclear energy, cold fusion also created a huge amount of controversy. Many physicists insisted that fusion could not occur at any measurable degree at room temperature. Then and now, conventional fusion experiments rely on very powerful magnets or lasers to heat nuclei to millions of degrees to overcome their mutual repulsion. The biggest fusion reactor today, known as ITER, is being built in the south of France to the tune of 20 billion euros. Now, a study funded by the U.S.-based technology giant Google has reinvestigated the original cold fusion results, as well as some of those from smaller number of groups that have continued to study the hypothetical phenomena. Many scientists consider such research a waste of time, pointing to the many failed attempts at reproducing cold fusion observations. But Matthew Trepik and colleagues at Google reckon that those failures might have been due to technical problems rather than the impossibility of cold fusion. Quote, there were very few data available to assess whether cold fusion is correct or not, said Trepik, who takes a special interest in alternative energy sources. In 2015, Trepik approached Curtis Blinquist, a chemist at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and then put together a roughly 30-strong research team using $10 million of funding from Google, a small fraction of the company's total research budget. The team has managed to keep its work under wraps until now, to the extent that even some of Berlin Gitt's own research group were unaware of it. Now the team leaders describe the results in a perspective article in Nature. Among its objectives, the team wanted to find out just how much deuterium they could pack into an electrode. Normally, palladium absorbs about 0.7 hydrogen atoms for each atom in the metal lattice, according to a long-standing claim. However, fusion could kick in if this reached 0.875, although the researchers exceeded this threshold just twice over the course of several dozen tests. Berlinquist says they now better understand how to boost absorption and limit leaks. Our data confirms that hydrogen likes to enter palladium nanoparticles at vertices and not faces, he explains. That gives some clues about how to design material to get a higher sustained hydrogen concentration. Let me drop for a second. The team also spent a lot of time trying to understand the potential pitfalls involved in measuring heat fluxes under extreme conditions. For many years, researchers in Italy have claimed that certain metallic powders yield excess energy when heated within hydrogen gas. So Berlinquist and colleagues modeled, built, and tested several colorimeters to try and pin down all the possible ways that heat could flow into and out of a cold fusion experiment. Heating 420 samples of nickel powder, they found that none provided evidence of excess heat. The team also looked at work done in the mid-1990s at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. The Los Alamos team did low-energy tabletop experiments that used a pulsed plasma discharge to drive deuterons into a palladium cathode. They reported detecting tritium, which is a byproduct of fusion. In research described in the Nature article, Thomas Schenkel and colleagues at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California carried out similar experiments for weeks at a time, but saw no enhanced production of tritium. Overall, the researchers concluded that they have found no evidence of anomalous effects claimed by proponents of cold fusion that cannot otherwise be explained prosaically. Nevertheless, they maintain that their research leaves open the possibility that cold fusion is real. Indeed, Trepik says that realizing what is known as a reference experiment providing evidence of cold fusion that is unambiguous and independently verifiable is our goal. Plus, he adds, the research could prove useful in other areas. One example is the analysis of how hydrogen is absorbed by palladium, something he and his colleagues write, which is relevant to energy storage, catalysts, and sensing. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
A VDH with a question?
Yes, John.
Is the hydrogen absorbed into the lattice of the palladium? I know fuel cells use use palladium, and I think in their membrane to absorb the hydrogen to start the reaction. I was just wondering, is the hydrogen actually absorbed into the lattice, and is that how they're saying it's initiating fusion? Okay.
Yeah, the concept apparently is that the palladium act as a catalyst to this spontaneous cold fusion. So they're absorbed on the surface. I mean, they don't burrow deep into it, but they have to be in close contact with the palladium atoms themselves in order for the interaction for the apparent activation of the catalysm.
Are they contending that this will actually overcome the normal repulsion of the hydrogen nuclei to each atom, and therefore bringing them close enough to fuse?
That is basically their theory. That's totally, utterly, and completely unproven. The sun does the same thing. It has the benefit of enormous pressures and enormous temperatures. And even at that, the half-life of the formation of deuterium is in the millions of years. So I tend to have a problem, as do actual physicists, with the concept that you can somehow get around the electromagnetic repulsive forces that are in play before the strong nuclear forces have a chance to interact. That's really the secret. If somehow you can overwhelm the electromagnetic repulsion of two protons long enough to get them close enough where the strong nuclear force begins to work, because although the strong nuclear force is magnitude stronger than electromagnetism, it is effective only at very, 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 very small distances. So the trick is, if you could just force those two protons together close enough, yes, you too could have deuterium. But the question is, how do you do that? And the answer that most physicists say is they don't have a clue.
And I guess if you did get them close enough to fuse, then the resultant energy would blow the whole lattice apart. So it would sort of be self-destructive. Okay.
Not necessarily. It would have to do with the rate of the transition. As long as you kept the rate of the transition low, you might be able to maintain the structure of the palladium, and that's what they think that they saw. They think that they saw deuterium being created on the palladium plates, and then the deuterium spontaneously interacted with more hydrogen and gave them tritium. It's a matter of degree. If it's doing it enough, yes, the whole equipment blows up and goes bad. But if you keep the level, and the whole concept, theoretically, again, is that you're doing this cold. You're doing this non-thermally, so the energy rate is small, but it's perpetual. So it would, if it worked, it would give you a low amount of energy for an extended period of time. Except that no one who knows how these things should work has a clue why it should work.
Okay, thanks, Roy. Appreciate it.
Welcome. Anyone else with any questions or comments before I roll it up for tonight? Okay, very well. As always, it's been a pleasure. I appreciated everyone who participated, and I hope you enjoyed the puzzle. I hope you enjoyed the stories. If you have any topics, subjects that you'd like to hear discussed, like CRISPR, please. The email address is mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra, that's ac2gs.com. The links to all these stories will be visible within minutes at roy.ac2g.com. And as always, I thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a great field day next week. So this is AC2GS, and I'll turn it over to Dick so he can turn it over to Paul for the space report.
Thank you, Roy. Looking forward to next week. Paul, what's NASA doing? WS2M, K2RIW. Go ahead with the space report.
This is WS1 for the SpaceNet report. And, hopefully I'll make field day Saturday, not Sunday. We'll see. That's the hope. A lot of topics that we came up with this week. But one I wanted to go back to was last week. We ran out of time. I was going to start talking about the InSight mission to Mars, which actually landed there at the end of last year. And that's the one that's been trying to study the inside of the Martian surface. It's not a rover. It's permanently in one position. And they had three main experiments on board. One is a radio transmission directly from Earth. It gets up to the, spacecraft sitting on the planet and comes back, and they can tell exactly how far the spacecraft is away within inches, and therefore they could actually, over time, tell what kind of a wobble that the planet has. That one is working fine, and then there's two other missions, experiments on board. One is the seismometer, which is, again, is also working well. That's the one where the robotic arm took the seismometer and placed it on the surface of Mars, and then they put a cover on top of that, so any of the winds or, you know, that might be on Mars would not affect the measurements, and that all worked. They're getting measurements back from that. One experiment has failed is the heat probe experiment. They have a what's called a mole. In other words, the mole is going to hammer itself down roughly 15 feet deep into the surface, and that's the goal. And then it was going to drag behind it this line that is connected to the spacecraft, and after it was all the way down, it's supposed to give measurements as it's going down, all the different heat measurements in the Martian surface. It was actually going to give off some heat, and, you know, as it went down, and it was going to take measurements on how fast that heat was given up, and by that information, they could extrapolate all the way into the center of Mars. Well, that particular experiment has failed because the mole got stuck. The robotic arm picked up the whole carriage, all set up, and put it onto the surface of Mars. And then this mole starts hammering itself, and then it leaves this setup that it's encased in with the ribbon wire and everything. It leaves that and starts hammering itself into the ground. Unfortunately, he only got about 12 inches down. They said around 30 centimeters. So it's around 12 inches down into the ground, and it's on a bit of an angle, do you think? So then it stopped. So either one of two things happened. Either it hit a rock, that's the first thought, but then they're also thinking that the ground, the surface area in that area is much softer than was predicted to be. So that means that as it's hammering itself down, it doesn't have enough tension surrounding it to hold itself back, so it's basically hopping up and down. So the people at JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, you know, they have a test bed with the exact same setup that we have on Mars, and they've been running tests. And they think that the soft surface is probably what's causing the problem. Once they get down deeper, there'll be enough resistance to hold it in place so it continues to go in the forward direction. So it's the only way they can check. They first have to see what's going on, and they think that by removing this whole carriage setup that was put onto the surface and leaving the mole stuck in the ground, might help, because they could take that whole carriage set up off, and then they could take photographs of the mole and get a little bit better idea of what's going on. And once they do that, they do have a plan. If it is a soft surface, they plan on taking a robotic arm, pushing the dirt next to the mole, pushing down on the dirt with the robotic arm. In a sense, making that dirt temporarily more dense, causing more resistance on the mole, and then they could start again. You know, it's an electric motor that turns this weight on the inside, pushes up against the spring, and then when it gets to a certain point, it gets released and forces itself in a forward direction. That whole setup is inside this mole. And they think that might work. So they're working on that, and my guess is it might take a month or two before they to get this done. It apparently it's a painstaking process. You know, you have to, you know, first remove the setup, take pictures. They plan on doing three different setups. You know, you bring the carriage away a little at a time, different pictures. So this might take a long time before they ever figure out what the problem is and whether or not their solution is going to work. But that's what they're doing at JPL. So we'll see what happens in the near future. Hopefully that system works. But you know, it's one of the many spacecraft that are involved with Mars right now. You have one other rover that's riding around on Mars, the Mars Curiosity rover. The other two that we had are no longer operating. Opportunity and Spirit. But someday in the not too distant future, there's going to be another rover to join the Curiosity rover, and that will probably land early 2021. I know it's going to take off in 2020, I believe in November or so, maybe a little bit before. Let me drop it to WS2M. Any questions before I move on? Okay, on June 24th, which is next Monday, not tomorrow, but next Monday, you have two events that NASA is going to be very interested in, and also SpaceX. NASA has a landing coming in on the 24th of three astronauts from the International Space Station. You have David Jock from Canada returning. He's been up there about almost 6 months. The same with Ann McClain, the American astronaut. And the Soyuz spacecraft will be flown by Oleg Koniecko. He also was up there for almost 6 months. They'll be returning. They'll leave Alex Ovechkin, Nick Hague, and Christina Koch up there for themselves for a little while, and not too long from now they have another launch. Three more people will join them, but those three will be alone for a little bit. And Christina Koch is the American astronaut, along with Nick Hague, and she got the okay for an extended mission, so she went up there thinking maybe 5-6 months. No, she's going to be almost a year, just short of a year. So, good luck to Christina, and good luck to the crew that's coming back on the 24th. Also on June 24th, SpaceX has a launch, Falcon Heavy, they've launched two of these Falcon Heavies. This is the one with three boosters that are attached together. You have a central core, and then you have one on the port side, one on the starboard side, also big boosters. So you wind up with 27 engines going off at the same time. They're placing 24 satellites. Most of them are military satellites, but there's some NASA ones, the NOVA ones, into four different orbits, which means the second stage of the Falcon Heavy, it's the first time that it's going to reignite four times. It's done it two times before, launch, you'll have an ignition, and then later on it'll ignite again. But this time they're doing four different restarts to put these satellites in different orbits. So, 24 different satellites, and there's a couple of interesting ones going up. One of them is, three are going to be CubeSats, ham-related, and then you're going to have, they're called Birds 3. You have beacons coming down, that type of thing. I'll have to get more information on the satellites correction. The Burns 3 are going to be launched from the International Space Station, not from the Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy has the other ones. Let me drop it. The Falcon Heavy is going to be launching, like I said, three boosters. They wanted to save all three boosters. It's going to be a night flight. It's going to go up like 11:30 at night. And two of the boosters are going to return to landing zone one and landing zone two back at Cape Canaveral. They'll come flying through the sky. You'll have dual sonic booms, and they're going to land vertically. Now, they've done this before. This is the third flight of the Falcon Heavy. And every time they've been able to save the two boosters, the central booster, which is going to land on a drone ship, which is